Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And today we're going to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. I know we want to talk about some invasive stink bugs, the marmorated one, but we can also talk about carpenter ants and any other insect question that you might have. If you have some photos, maybe you've got a photo of an insect that you don't know what the heck it is and you want to send it to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, you can do that. And I bet you Phil can identify it. And also, if you got maybe just a pretty picture of an insect, I love those too. So post those on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, along with questions too. You can email us as well at talk@wpr.org, or, of course, give a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Phil, great to see you. Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
We have the brown marmorated stink bug. You know, at Garden Expo, we were talking. I was giving a little presentation with a couple of other people, and one of the people in the crowd said, "Here," and held up her finger, and on her finger was a brown marmorated stink bug. So we took it to the front, and Lisa Johnson identified it and talked a little bit about it. I had one on my daughter's bedroom ceiling last night. Only one. Some people have had lots of them.
Yeah, it's starting to take off. And it's been my experience, too. At Garden Expo, I was surprised at the number of people came up and chatted about seeing some in their house. I was down in Janesville a couple weeks ago giving a talk, and sure enough, the place I was at, down at the gardens down there, there were marmorated stink bugs in the women's restroom, and they were brought out. And so, I'm not surprised. In fact, maybe I'll say from the time I've retired, it's been a little bit slow, but it's getting the kind of momentum that it's kind of evolving to what we expected. We're just starting to see damage in apple crops and vegetables, but really the biggest problem is this nuisance coming in. And you know, if it's 3 or 4, it's not a problem. When it starts to get 3 or 4 dozen, that's something gets people's attention. And unfortunately, if it evolves like it has out east, we're going to have people that have thousands in. And all this stems from last fall, just like box elder bugs and some of these other things. They're migrating in, and now the walls are warming up, and they're waking up and trying to get outside.
And I should mention that we have a great photo of a marmorated stink bug on our Facebook page already at the Larry Mueller Show. So if you want to take a look at what one looks like, they're kind of a shield. I would call it a shield top on their body.
Yeah, and that's typical of the stink bugs. And we have 3 or 4 native species of stink bugs, which really don't cause us these kind of problems. But this Asian species now that is been here for about 6 years. In fact, PJ and I were talking. Mm-hmm. We got 3 new county records already this year or this winter in particular. Mm. And it's pretty much the southeast part of the state, south central, and it's going to continue to migrate through is what we expect.
Yeah. Well, what do we do? You know, it's typical things that you would do in the fall, I suppose, to keep them from getting in.
Yeah, it's a combination of, the best thing is to solve the riddle of where they're squeezing in, because that's a permanent solution. You don't have to mess with them. If that doesn't work, there are sprays that can be applied to the outside of the house, but the critical thing is you've got this window, and you need to stop them in September and early October. You know, at this time of the year, you just sweep them up or, catch them in a jar, let them go, whatever, because it really doesn't matter. And the main thing to keep in mind is they're not breeding indoors. As I said, everything that you see is basically has something that's migrated in this past fall.
I can tell you they are a little stinky, because the one that was in my daughter's bedroom, I finally dispatched, and I was trying to kill it without making it squish, and I squished it, and it stinks.
You turn them over, and they've got these great big round discs, which we call their stink glands, and it is a good defense.
It definitely is. Mark in Milwaukee has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Mark.
Hi, fellas. Just rather an observation, possibly a question. My son was stationed in San Antonio, Texas, and he sent me a close-up of a wasp. Now, I don't know if it was a wasp, a hornet. Up here in Wisconsin, we got the nice little inch-long ones with the handsome yellow and black bands. Mm-hmm. This thing literally looked prehistoric. It had armored legs. You know where the joint is articulated? There was a break in the armor. But I don't know. I guess my question is, there's so many permutations of wasp or hornet. Have you ever seen anything that big or that heavily constructed in a flying wasp.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there is a giant hornet in Asia that is just an amazing creature. But I suspect this may be the southern version, or and it's a different species than our cicada killers that you were mentioning here, especially because of the size. I mean, there just is not that many things that start approaching that inch and a half size. And most of them are solitary hornets or wasps. I mean, it's interesting, those terms you would think have good definitions, but they don't. Something can be a wasp or a hornet, and they said entomologists are always kind of confusing people, unfortunately, with some of this. But I would wonder, it's one of the cicada killers would be the first thing I would think of from your description of being stout-bodied and the like. And as I said, there are some species in the Southwest that we do not see up here.
Oh. And, sir?
Go ahead.
For my clarification, the little ones that swarm, and if you see one, you see 20, and you better run, because they sting first and ask questions later. Mm-hmm. Are those wasps?
Well, first of all, yellow jackets are the term often given. Those are ground-nesting paper wasps.
Oh.
They are technically not a hornet. Whereas some of the larger ones, but they said it gets confusing. I mean, bees and wasps are very easy to define. They, you know, have different purposes and stuff. But when you get the wasp and hornet, that's where we get some overlay in the entomological world.
Cool. Well, thank you. I'll keep my distance from them Asian ones then.
Yeah, I ran my lawnmower over one of those holes and wound up, I don't know, I had 8 or 9 bites. Many on the face, and you know, you're suddenly what's going on here? You're getting bitten. You don't. I mean, it's quick.
Yeah.
they're quick to defend.
Unfortunately, when they sting, they give off chemicals that agitate the rest of the colony, and so yes, they will do anything they can to defend because they feel threatened. And we have a lot of problems in late summer with lawnmowers and other things that people aren't aware that these ground nesters are there. And said, I mean, they can have 3,000 or 4,000 individuals in the colony, so it can really get pretty serious pretty fast.
James in Eau Claire up next. Hi, James. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Mary. Thanks for taking my call. And this question kind of goes to the last subject. I learned that Wisconsin has cow killer ants, and I found out that that's really a wingless wasp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the most masculine thing to say, but I'm a little worried about them. Can I run into them?
All right. Well, I tell you what. We're having you're not coming through particularly clearly, James, but... his question has to do with cow killer ants,
right.
Which I don't know. We ever talked about them before?
No, because they're not overly common here. You do find them in some sandy areas. They're very interesting creatures. They are, as he had mentioned, a wingless wasp. They are fuzzy and awfully brightly colored, black and yellows, orange and blacks. You know, they might even be mistaken for a beetle because that color gets your attention. But they are basically parasites of other things, and they use the stinger to paralyze their prey, among other things. And so they don't truly kill cows, but it's something if you ever got stung by one, it would keep your attention for quite some time. It's a painful type thing. But as I said, they're so infrequent, they're not aggressive. If you pick them up and handle them, you might get stung. Even then... You know, I wouldn't be overly concerned, although if my grandson saw one, I would make sure he didn't touch it.
Maybe
a good way to put it. So as I said, if you go hunting them down, there are at least 2 or 3 species I know here. In general, the group is much more prevalent in deserts and in much warmer climates.
Are they kind of like fire ants?
Well,
we don't have fire ants.
Right,
but.
No, they're quite a bit bigger. And, you know, fire ants live in colonies, and we've got that whole thing to deal with. These are individuals that go through. And, again, they're best thought of as a wingless wasp, and the sting would remind you of a wasp sting in connection.
Gotcha. James, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, you can join in, too, if you have a question. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. 1-2-3-4. It was open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. John in Glendale, you're up. Thanks, John.
Hi, fellas. Yeah, I started a walking program on August 17th, and I was out walking, and these biting flies and mosquitoes are after me, and it's pretty miserable. So I went out the next day, same area, same weather, you know, kind of warm and muggy, same time. And no bugs at all, no biting bugs at all. And it was that way all the way through September, and I stopped recording them. But I mean, it's never bothered me since. It's like in that one day, they were gone.
Hmm.
I couldn't explain
Maybe
that.
There was a flush or something.
There's so many possibilities. You know, you talk about mosquitoes and black flies and horse flies and deer flies. You know, the one that I would say is typically you can get this kind of on again, off again are black flies, because we know that they can blow 20 or 30 miles or more from the aquatic breeding sites that they have. And so you can have them blow into an area and then all of a sudden they kind of blow out. You know, mosquitoes and other things don't generally, even though we get mosquitoes that migrate big distances, they just kind of, if you're in a habitat that has them, it should always have them. So it's a little hard to explain from my side of things, and especially we were a bit on the wetter side this year, which keeps the mosquitoes happy. And, you know, I basically was bothered by mosquitoes well into late September, early October. You know, with each individual creature, they have humidities that they're active, amounts of sunlight, amount of wind. I mean, there's a bunch of these variables you can explain. And generally speaking, you know, sunny, windy days or whatnot should not be a problem. You get towards dusk when the humidities go up, the light levels go down, the wind levels go up. That's when often many of the biting insects seem to be most active.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks a lot, John, for calling. Appreciate it. We had Edwin on Facebook who wonders, oh, this is a good question. What does marmorated mean for a marmorated stink bug?
Yeah, it means marbled. So basically, if you look at one, it's kind of this mottled, you know, it's not a solid brown. In fact, it's almost artsy if you look at one close enough.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the stink bugs really are, if you get past the odor side, kind of attractive when you put them underneath a microscope. So, as I said, it does refer to that kind of mottled light brown, dark brown that's involved in the back of the critter.
Carpenter ants, I mentioned at the start of the show, and before we go back to the phones, let's talk about them for a minute. You know, they start moving this time of the year, don't they?
The thing about, you know, when somebody would see a black ant in the house and we're trying to decipher, is it a nest inside or not, is when did you see your first ant? And the ants outside will not be active at least for 2 months, if not longer. So even the sighting of one or two ants at this time of the year, you know, medium to large black ants, suggests carpenter ants. And what usually that is a colony that's an outside wall or somewhere else. It's finally warmed up enough that they think it's spring. And what you find with these very early activity, it's usually workers going after water. What we think they're doing is trying to bring water in, increase the humidity within the colony so they can start raising young. So as I said, it is very, very distinctive and suggestive of a problem in the house, whereas you saw a couple in July on the bathroom sink, and they could just be wandering from outside.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's a sign that, and they're not causing the damage as much as they are going to a place that in your home that's already damaged, right?
Right. As we've talked about before, somebody made a mistake by calling them carpenter ants. And in typically outdoor situations, they're in rotting wood in trees or stumps.
Yeah.
And they often will move in water-damaged wood. They're looking for something soft, and they don't eat the wood. They eat insects and other things, but they excavate it. And the other problem we have in houses is they get into insulation board and styrofoam and those kind of things because it's easy for them to excavate.
Sure.
And so they're looking just for places to move into. Now, it's a classic. You know, you find out you got a leak in the roof. The roofer goes up there. He says, you got ants. They ruined your roof. Well, the water ruined your roof, it softened it up, and the ants moved in afterwards is what the story is. And so sometimes, you know, you're trying to get people to realize that they may have done you a favor by showing where you did have a water problem so you can address it. And old windowsills, I mean, just those things that soften up are the kind of things that they like to get into.
Phil Pelletieri, our distinguished faculty associate emeritus professor, I guess we could call him.
Old guy.
he's an old guy, but he's pretty smart when it comes to insects. And he's our guest. You can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Lexi Broad, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will take a look at the skyrocketing cost of childcare and how that impacts families. That's at 2 today. Right now, taking a look at the insects of Wisconsin with our guest, Phil Pelletieri. Thanks so much for joining us. And again, you can call in 1-800-642-1234. If you have an insect you want to identify, and sometimes you can do that with a description, but a photo always helps. And you can send a photo to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's where you go for that. Meredith in Wisconsin Dells, we turn to you. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I learned so much on this show.
Oh, thanks.
Last year, I was pulled a weed out of my flower garden, and I made sure it wasn't one of those stinging nettles because we have them throughout our property.
Yeah.
It wasn't that, but I was in so much pain for like a day and a half. My hand just burned and burned, and the next day I seen like a couple little holes in the red area. And I seen a show on TV that said that there's a new stinging caterpillar in our area.
Okay.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that, because I'm thinking maybe that's what it was.
Not new that I am aware of. There are a handful of caterpillars that have what we call urticating hairs, and it's just like stinging nettle. When you get the hair in you, it breaks off and it gives off chemicals that burn. And they're not overly common, but the Io moth is one that would have that, and there are a handful of other ones.
What is it?
Io refers, the adult is a wild silkworm that has two dots in the back. It is a defense mechanism in a small number of caterpillars. It would a best way to describe it. It's like a nettle.
I like caterpillars. I didn't know they would hurt me.
Yeah, if you're gentle with them, it's not a problem, because, again, the problem is if the hairs break off and they get stuck. Now, we also have even things like gypsy moths, where they do not have the poison glands associated with the hairs, but their hairs can get stuck, and they're almost like, if you run into a thistle or whatnot, where you get all those little prongs or the like. And so that's another irritation that we get. Sometimes, a caterpillar falls down somebody's shirt and they kind of rub it. Well, again, they break off the hairs and they get a rash-like symptom, but you wouldn't expect the burning.
It burned like the nettle, but I even went back and looked at the weed, and it wasn't a nettle. It hurt so bad for so long. I thought, what in the world?
No, it really does sound like you had it, but, typically it's hard to see the distinct punctures where it is, and the thing I was just a little suspicious of, there's only a couple punctures that kind of indicates to me more likely a bite or a sting, but as I said, with it as sudden as it happened and the like, it definitely can happen, and as I said, we do have these things. You could find them anywhere in the state, but if you told me to go out and look for them, it would take me some time. They're not overly common.
I was just curious about it, because I'd never heard that a caterpillar could sting you, so it was like scary to me. I thought, sure. I'm going to leave them alone too now.
Well, you're one of the lucky ones, Meredith. There aren't many out there that get stung, but you were one. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Doug in Madison, you're next. Hi, Doug.
Hi, guys. So let's talk about flies for a moment.
Okay.
Last couple of years, my wife and I, we live out in the country. The last couple of years, we'll come home once or twice a year, and it's like we've had a hatching of really big black flies in our home, maybe as many as 20, and, we track them all down and get rid of them, but just curious to know if you've heard of anything like that, what might cause that?
Yeah, so, it depends on the pattern, and I, in my own household, just about Christmas, I saw a couple flies, and the problem is many of these things you would describe as a house fly, some a little bigger, some a little smaller, some shiny, some not, and what they look like is important because it points to the direction of the problem. And so what happened in our household is a little smaller than a house fly, and if you looked at them carefully, they're a little bit metallic. Those are flesh flies. So something died somewhere, and the question to me was how big. And it was interesting because I go down the basement every day, and I had still a couple little butterfly nets, and I would capture them as they're flying around the lights. And I was interested in how many it would end up. And so over a week's period of time, I caught 123 critters.
Oh.
And then it stopped, just like you shut a light off. And so I knew whatever died was bigger than a mouse, but not so big that we ever could detect any foul odor. So, you know, I don't know if it was a squirrel in the attic. And so I really never solved it, but it kind of evolved what I normally expect. So this kind of big explosion then goes away very quickly. That's typically associated with a dead animal.
Okay.
The other problem where we had this consistent problem in the late fall through the spring, we talk about cluster flies. And cluster flies look just like house flies. But their story, like these fall invaders that we talk about, they come in, they get in the wall voids, they get in the attic, and then on warm days, some wake up. And so this, it's a constant trickle. Although you get a correlation, the warmer it is outside or the sunnier it is outside, the more flies that wake up and bother people. And there you would expect, again, living in a rural area, it would be relatively constant in the winter. And so as I said, from your description of it being just an isolated, intense incident, as I said, something, a bird, whatever, died in a place. And, you know, if it was something large, I think the odor would get to you.
Sure.
You know, we've had problems with raccoons dying in chimneys and whatnot. And then, you know, a raccoon, I could probably expect to find a few hundred flies emerging. Wow. And then again, you'd expect the odor. So, you know, it's not worth... I always tell people, you know, the good news is it will run its course because they run out of food, among other things. The carcass dries down, so it's no longer suitable for breeding flies. If you're lucky enough to be able to find it and can clean it up good, but it's not worth tearing walls apart. And as I said, more often than not, it just kind of runs its course and things are done.
Yeah, we've never found anything bigger than a mouse ever, and those are few and far between.
Yeah. You know, I would speculate a mouse probably under ideal conditions might give me 20 flies, maybe 30 at the most. And so, as I said, that's why I knew right away. I was thinking it was a mouse because, you know, like everybody, you have a few mice run around in the house once in a while. But it was definitely something bigger. And I am curious.
Chipmunk?
But I'm not sure. Yeah, a chipmunk would fit that. And, you know, why? You know, what was a little weird is, you know, Christmas, it was cool enough. You know, with insects, you pretty well have to figure the temperature's got to be above 50 degrees for them to be active in breeding. And so it had to be someplace relatively warm to keep it going. But there is this relationship that if it's relatively on the cool side, it will be slower in developing. So, you know, you could have it pop 2 months after it happened if things were at 55 degrees, let's say, consistently.
I don't remember much of what the flies looked like other than they were really, really big and they were fairly black, very dark.
Yeah, the thing about the flesh flies and blowflies, which are another ones that feed on carrion, is they typically tend to be quite bristly. So again, big black spines all over the body, pretty robust. And then a good majority of them have a metallic tint, metallic greens, metallic blues, although sometimes you got to get some light on it, whereas house flies are really very dull when you put things on. And house flies, typically you don't expect. I mean, they'd be associated with a garbage can or something like that. And I think most people, because it would be in the living space, would know what was going on.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling,
Thanks,
Doug. Yeah, appreciate the call. Mike in Lake Mills, hello
Hi,
to
Gary.
You.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Question, we recently bought a house on about a half acre in the middle of Lake Mills, and we're lucky to have the lake in our backyard and a big marsh across the street, but we have a nice garden. I was thinking of putting in a single beehive for honeybees, but I wondered if that would be too much competition for the bumblebees and the ground bees and the wild foragers.
I don't think so. You know, a lot of plants that humans have developed have been... developed that honeybees have a preference for, but we find that a lot of our native bees and whatnot have plenty of stuff, and so I really don't think I think there's more than enough go around, but I think there is little niches that some of these wild bees are active in. The honeybees have no interest in those plants and the like, and so no, I wouldn't worry about the competition.
Great, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Jake sent us a photo on Facebook, and he says, a cool little guy hanging out on some lady tress orchid flowers. And I think...
It looks like an immature insect, because I don't see the wings. And from the general body shape and whatnot, I think it is an assassin bug. That's my first thing. Now, there's a couple, three other, you know, critters, but the way it's behaving and the like, and, you know, as the name implies, they like to sit in kind of ambush and wait for their prey to come by. And, of course, since so many things come to flowers, that's not a bad decision on its part. What's interesting is the adults can often be quite a bit different coloration than the nymphs. So you can see this one's green, so he's pretty well camouflaged, but
And he's right next to a flower, and he's kind of drooping, kind of like the flower is. So.
Oh, yeah. No, and there's even another family of these we call assassin bugs. In particular, they you see them on goldenrod, and they are yellow and black.
Oh.
They're very robust, and this one you can't. This species you don't see it, but in some of them you see these huge front legs, which are very muscular for grabbing prey and the like. So ambush assassin bugs. I mean, there's all kinds of neat predators in particular. And this is a group of critters that, again, they're fun to observe. You got to be a little careful handling them because being predators the way they are, they have the opportunity to bite.
Yeah,
it will get your attention.
So as you're listening and you want to take a look at that, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show and go to visitor posts over kind of on the right side of the page and click there and you'll see that particular photo. Let's go to Todd in La Crosse. Hi, Todd.
Hello. Hello, hi. Yes, I'm interested in, there's this kind of bad pest, spotted wing Drosophila, Drosophila that attacks raspberries, and we have had it. A bit, but what have you been seeing? Is it spreading? Is it overwintering? Is it going to be worse in the future?
That's a good question. So this is a relatively recent invasion in the whole United States. Our first records were 2010 in Wisconsin. I think the first records in the U.S. were 2008. So it spread very quickly. It is a pest of small fruits, in particular in the late summer. And so the pattern is there is no question it overwinters here. It is primarily a raspberry, blueberry, little bit on cherry, very rarely on grape. Thank goodness not on cranberry. And what is somewhat perplexing to us is that we do not see it in the spring. And fruit flies breed continuously when things are warm. And so why aren't they in the summer strawberries, especially the spring strawberries? I can't say I have not seen them in strawberries, but that was not very common. And so we know they're overwintering here, but the pattern does seem to be when they get an area, I don't expect them to go away. The disappointment for people growing raspberries is now we've got a high maintenance issue. And what makes this thing such a problem is it's laying its eggs when the fruit is still green. So you don't even know it's there. So by the time you harvest it, it's already in there and infested, and so it becomes a high maintenance issue. You're applying a number of sprays to get you through a growing season, and you know that's the kind of maintenance. And you know a lot of people are not comfortable with spraying their fruit, and so it has really kind of changed the equation. But in general, you will find your earlier bearing raspberries you can often get through. Without a problem, but it is basically the summer in early fall that, you know, the everbearings and whatnot that you get the pressure later on. And that's the pattern. It seems about the 15th of July, you start to get the trickle of activity, and then it just picks up after that.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Sorry. All right, thanks. Yeah, sorry. Thanks, Todd.
You know, I always tease. We were talking with a number of people at Garden Expo about this, and as he said, we were excited that they didn't get into cranberries, and it starts to look like that thicker skin fruit is not susceptible. So if somebody could breed a thick-skinned raspberry, we may have a solution. Now, one of the other things that hurts us here is we know they're breeding in buckthorn and honeysuckle and a whole bunch of wild plants, and so it's not as if it's just a problem. And so when you see that kind of activity, you can see what a problem it's going to be.
Bob and Slinger, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello. I would like some information on paper wasps. There's a method of trapping them. I've seen something on the internet on how to build a trap, but I would like if you have any information on locations and bait colors.
Yeah. So I'm always a little bit leery because typically the way a paper wasp colony builds, it starts in the spring with a single queen. In June and early July, the numbers are so low they don't concern us. Typically, they're a problem for most of us in August and September, and at that time, there can be hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals in the nest. And because they start scavenging on sugar and protein, you see them around garbage cans and the like, and that's what the traps are basically doing, is they're using something that usually is sweet and smelling in a way that would attract them. But the problem there is you're just catching individual workers. And so you really don't catch enough of them, in my opinion, and much of the research that I've seen published on it, catch enough of them to destroy the colonies. They, you know, the best way to destroy a colony is if you know where it is, you go and treat it, you kill the queen. There's no way that they can repopulate after that.
And so I have seen on the information is if you set your trap early in the spring, baited with meat, if you can catch the queen, if she's out hunting and you catch the queen, you got a head start on the whole thing.
Right, but, you know, my experience, you know, the queen is only active foraging for food for a very short period of time because once she raises some workers, they do all the legwork. And I almost think, from what I've seen, so the first wasps you see in the spring are queens. That's all they are. There's fertilized queens that are going to start things. If you see an area that they're active, you can spray dust, seal, whatever. If you stop them then, that's what's going to be more effective. You're got a better chance, I guess I'm saying, than if you just put out some meat scraps, which are going to attract a bunch of flies and all kinds of critters. But the probability of bringing a queen in, I think, is pretty small.
And what do damage, or I mean, do you need to be afraid of paper wasps?
Well, if they're located in a place that there's no people and pet activity, we don't worry about them. Now, we have both the ground nesters and we got the above-ground nesters. So typically, you know, when people are aware of it, again, we're well into the building of the colony. And what I usually would try to help them assess is if somebody bumps into it or falls into it or whatnot, this can be very serious. And so those are the nests that need to be treated. A nest that you can see 15, 20 feet up in a tree, there's
Why
no
bother?
Reason to bother with
yeah.
them. So, for a good portion of the year, they're beneficial. They go out and collect caterpillars and other things that we would define as our plant pests and use them for food to feed their young. So that's a good behavior. But the problem with them, again, is they are so aggressive if the nest is threatened, and that's where we have this problem. So, if it's under the stoop next to the front door, you really do have to deal with it. But if it's out in the woods, don't bother. Now, on the other side, when you're trying to eat outdoors in the late summer, you always have to be cautious because, as I said, both sugar and protein attract them. We get a lot of people, they're sitting on their pop cans or, you know, they don't notice it on the sandwich when they bite it, and we get problems there. Although, interesting enough, you know, as I'm trying to write my book, and I'm making progress. That's
good.
But one of the things that you know, I had witnessed is when the German yellow jacket, which is the one that gave us so much problem back in the 90s and early 2000s, the amount of problems of that insect, being that garbage bee that we always talk about, has dropped dramatically. I mean, there just is not the populations we used to see. And so I remember when my kids were small and we'd go for a picnic, if we didn't have a butterfly net to catch the wasps that were attacking us, we couldn't picnic.
Yeah,
I don't see that anymore. I mean, I see some of it, but not at that level. So things have changed. We think, I know my colleague Bob Jean and his students had worked with some of this, and we think there are some diseases that may be playing into this. But we have a number of native species, so it's not as if the paper wasp will go away. So as I said, I the traps have their purpose. Sometimes they use them in outdoor restaurants and whatnot to try to reduce the number of foragers. As I said, it's such a numbers game, and most of the time it doesn't work. The one time I saw a very interesting thing, a colleague that was in charge of pest control on campus, we had trouble with people getting stung at the football games because everybody's got pop and whatnot, and putting, you know, covers on the pop helps and the like. But what Doug did is he would go out with a pie plate filled with something real sweet like Mountain Dew. That seems to be a common thing people find as quite attractive. He wasn't trying to kill them. What he was doing was they'd come and fly in. He'd observe them. And once they got some Mountain Dew in their stomach, they would fly off and he would track them. And by doing this, and it did take a bit of a time, he'd all of a sudden discover where the nest is underneath a bush or whatnot. And so then when he treated the nest, he's literally taking out hundreds, if not thousands. And he thought that was quite effective because he could find, you know, 10, 15 nests around Camp Randall. That makes a big difference if you can remove them from the environment.
Wow, very interesting. Thanks again for calling, Bob. Let's go back to Facebook again. We saw that nice photo from Jake a little while back, and here's another one from Chris. This cool little spider was on our car door last May. She or he is a bit larger than a nickel. Could you identify that one? It is kind of a cool one.
It's probably
same
a she
color
from the
as
size.
The car.
In general, you know, the bigger spiders are the females, the smaller ones are the males. My first inclination, it is a fishing spider, and it's small for a fishing spider, but it also could be a wolf spider. The banding on the legs, the general pattern, if I had a bit more of a close-up. Now, what's deceptive about fishing spiders is they can be quite a ways away from water, and they're related to wolf spiders. And
sure.
They're kind of a wandering spider out looking for food. And as I said, some of the biggest spiders we have in the state are fishing spiders, so they really do get people's attention. But that banding of the legs, is as distinctive as anything else.
John in Wausau, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my skin is crawling. I got bit the other night by something and got a big red welt. And last night I went in my kitchen and found a millipede on the wall. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you can tell me, where do they live? Why do I have them? Do they bite? And how do you get rid of them?
Okay, so true millipedes feed on organic matter in the soil. They run around, and I'm guessing if you got bit by this critter, it's a centipede. Now, the difference, centipedes tend to be somewhat flattened. They have big, long, gangly legs. They run very quick, especially the one we find indoors. Millipedes, and they only have one leg per segment of their body. Millipedes, if you look at them closely, have two legs for every segment. They're much more rounded, much slower moving creatures. So if you had something that was kind of moving around and fast, it's not common to be bit by centipedes, but they're predators. And like many predators, they're capable of biting. And again, depending on how much venom they injected, you could expect a reaction. The more venom, the more problematic. Nothing, life-threatening, but it's like a bee sting. It's not a pleasant experience. So if it was a centipede, yes.
How do I get rid of them?
Good question. Now, the interesting thing is that the house centipede that we have is not native. It is a tropical species. We don't see it outdoors, but it does thrive indoors. The problem is that they are spending a lot of time in your wall voids and other places you can't get to. So a couple, three of the recommendations is the less clutter you have around, that means the less hiding places, hopefully less centipedes. They are slow to breed. They feed on insects, and there's not a whole lot of insects in most people to feed on, and that's why we never get overrun with them. One of the things that I've always liked, because spraying is not overly effective, but they sell, if you go to hardware stores and the like, they sell versions we call glue boards. And that's what it is, a piece of tacky cardboard. And if you placed it underneath a refrigerator or whatnot, if one of these things came running through, it would get captured on it and caught and die. If you've got pets or little kids, you got to be careful because you don't want them to get in glue boards. It's just a big mess. But it's kind of a non-toxic way of reducing numbers. And as I said, because there's not a whole bunch of these things around, in most of the centipedes spend most of their time in secluded places anyway. So as I said, down in a basement corner somewhere, maybe in your sill plate, if they're not insulated, you could put it there underneath bigger appliances. I said, then you got a chance of reducing the numbers and the like. You could use an ant spray, but again, it's such a hit and run. I mean, it's not as if they're always in one place. There's no such thing as a nest to go treat. And so that's why I don't find sprays to be all that effective.
Sure. John, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. By the way, if you want to find out more about the brown marmorated stink bug, I hope you'll go to the new WisContext website. WisContext is a service of the UW Extension, Wisconsin Public Radio, and Wisconsin Public Television. The web address is WisContext. Let me say that again. WisContext.org. So it's WisContext. .org. And the writers are really good. They do a nice job. So if you want to learn more about the marmorated stink bug, that's a good place to go. And Dennis wants to know about ants, I think, from Deerfield. So let's go there. Hi, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hey, this is something I've wondered about for a while. When I walk in the country on a road with a gravel shoulder, sometimes you'll find clusters of ant hills, maybe 5-6 feet of them, with lots and lots of hills. Sometimes it may go on for hundreds of feet along the side of the road. All kinds of ant hills, all kinds of ants running back and forth. Now, what kind of ant is, are those each cell a different nest?
Yes. So we call them field ants as a group. There is a number of species, and some of them will make nests upwards of 2 feet high and 6 feet wide if you give them the opportunity. Another common place to see them, if you burn a prairie or whatnot, you see these mounds, you know, and they look like about the size of a basketball, and those are individual nests, and there can be six of them right next to each other, and each one is a different colony. Now, not all field ants make large nests as far as height and what, but that would be my first inclination. They're medium to large black ants, or reddish black ants, or red and black ants. And interesting enough, they're not an ant that comes indoor for food. So they're not a nuisance as far as in the kitchen, although they do look very similar to carpenter ants to people. If you bother them, they cannot sting, but they will bite. And so you don't want to put the picnic blanket over a nest. But other than that, they're really pretty docile. The biggest complaint we used to get, I think, is if the nest was in a place in the yard, it would affect sometimes the lawnmower. Or again, if it's next to a play area for kids, you really can't let that happen because the kids would potentially get bit. They're not overly aggressive, but as I said, if you mess with them enough, they will bite. The other interesting thing is some of the species do not, or they temperature regulate the nest. And what I mean by this, if there's plants growing next to it, they will literally kill the plants because they shade the nest and they're trying to maintain a certain temperature for young rearing and the like. And so there are some that we have seen take out Christmas trees upwards of 3 or 4 feet tall, and they do this by injecting formic acid into the roots, and it kills the plant. So I normally don't expect ants to be plant killers, but in the vegetable garden next to your tomato plant, it's not a good pairing, as I said. That's one that either you move the tomato plant or you might have to deal with the ants. But
let me ask this, though. I mean, these, I know I've seen field nests, the big ones you're talking about. These are little hills. Yeah. They're all clustered together, but they're individual little hills. Each hill may be as 4 inches around.
Okay.
Go on and on down the road.
So if that size... there is a group that I know as cornfield ants. Now, the name is technically to one species, and there's about 8 or 9 species it could be. Those are the little red ants, or what some people would refer to as sugar ants. Again, very common. I've seen quotes of densities as high as 15 to 20 per square yard in the average lawn. And they are separate colonies, which is kind of interesting. They kind of... can coexist, might be a way of putting it. And also, you think they feed a lot on aphid honeydew. And so, you know, there's got to be some source of food to keep those kind of numbers up. That's the same ant that gives us the problem if you've got paving block and whatnot, and they kick the sand up because they like to nest in well-drained soil, typically, in sandy areas. And unfortunately, when people put sand and then put paving block over it, it creates the environment. The ants are nesting underneath it, and as they excavate underneath it, they kick up the sand and create a problem. They do sell special types of sand you can use that kind of has a sealer in it that you can put in, and it gives enough of a physical barrier that it can prevent that problem. But kind of an innocuous ant. That one, the cornfield ant and its relatives do occasionally come in. If you spill some fruit juice or whatnot and they find it, they will come in. But they kind of go hot and cold on you. When the things are cleaned up, they kind of go away.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Dennis. I have a photo from Elaine. And I'm trying to figure, it looks like a bee of some sort there on...
Yeah, I was looking closer. You know, my first inclination is it's a bumblebee colony because there's 3 or 4 bees that are on there. They appear somewhat fuzzy. You will find, you know, bumblebees nest in the ground like some of the yellow jackets and the like. And they also, we get them up underneath houses in the wall voids. And it looks like it might be insulation there. That they're nesting in.
Yeah.
Now, what they will create, I think that little brown patch next to the one bee may be some of the honey pots that we see in a bumblebee nest.
Oh.
Where they will store some of the nectar they get. They also raise young in little capsules, something like similar to that. So, as I said, I think that may have been a bumblebee colony that was exposed, and we see 3 or 4 of the bees. But most of that stuff looks to me like insulation.
On to Agnes in Park Falls. Agnes, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Yes, hello there, and thanks for your program and what you do. I'm wondering if you can help me with identifying this 1-inch long, basically black, and it has little crawly things underneath. But on top, it has four pair of brush-like cream-colored buzz things and a small brownish tail. I'm wondering what this is. I got it last fall.
You just saw one or you saw a bunch?
Pardon me?
Did you see a number of them or just find one?
Just one.
Okay. A little bit of a guess on my part, but from your description, there's a group of critters we call rove beetles. And the first thing about rove beetles is their wing covers are short, so they don't look like a classic beetle to most people. There are some of them you find in mushrooms and other things, but the one that you're describing, we often associate it as a predator on carrion. It feeds on maggots and other things. And so sometimes, again, if a bird dies in the attic, you get some flies, this thing will tend to show up. And so, as I said, from your description, if you can go on the internet and go under rove beetles, and you might have to look through a few of them, but if you put large rove beetle, because this is one of the larger species we have, I wonder, and they do have little tufts of yellowish or lighter hairs on the body. And so, as I said, it would fit that. But it would remind some people kind of an earwig. I mean, they're more that shape and in size and whatnot in pattern than it would be a beetle. But that would be my and they are attracted to night lights, too. So once in a while, you get one that comes in your security light by the door, and then in the morning, it kind of crawls in because it's looking for a place to hide. So.
And what did you call it again?
Rove, spelled R-O-V-E.
Oh, rove. So you could go online and take a look, Agnes. The Insect Diagnostic Lab may have a photo of it.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a obscure group. I mean, it's a large group of insects, but as I said, once you see it, you don't forget it, type of thing. But I'm not sure if PJ has something on it. But if you do a just an image search on Google or whatnot, I bet you will see one of these larger ones.
Yeah. Okay. There you go, Agnes. Thank you for calling. And here's a photo from Louise.
Testing my eyes.
A little guy on raspberries and in the garden every year.
It's a good guy. It looks like an aphid lion. Aphid lions are the immature stage of a lacewing. And so it's a predator. What I'm picking up are the bigger legs. And up on the front end, if you magnify them, they've got one pair of very pronounced jaws that they use to suck the juices out of their prey. And so that's a sign of something good. I mean, that will take care of the aphids on the plant quite easily. And they don't get very big, and so that fits.
And actually it was Lewis, not Louise. And Lewis has got his finger, it's sort of... What would you say? Not a half inch.
Right. Quarter? Yeah, I mean, the critter themselves, even a full-grown one, probably maybe 3/4 inch if you include the jaws. So they're not a big critter. They're quite fast-moving, which is classic of predators. Most of the plant-feeding things are slow-moving and the like. If things tend to move quite quickly, usually they are predaceous on something.
Let's go to Kate in Fox Valley next. Kate, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. I'll try to make them quick. The first, I have a cedar shake bungalow, and of course I have a lot of spiders. So that question is, do I have to treat outside to deal with the spiders that are inside every spring? And then my second question is about that paper wasp at the peak of my garage eave. There is a small, I think it's a paper wasp nest started. Would this be a good time of year when it's still cold for me to get up on a ladder and just put a bag around that and take that down? So those are my two questions.
You don't have to, because there are no species of paper wasps that we typically expect here that reuse their nest. And they're not in there now. The queens that were produced last fall go and fly and hide under rocks and other protected places. So, no worry to worry about that.
Okay.
The spiders, unfortunately, there's so many little nooks and crannies in that kind of cedar siding that there's a lot of places to hide for insects and the spiders.
Yeah.
Indoors, honestly, I think I'm just more of a proponent of getting out the shop vac with an attachment and getting back in all the corners and the like and using that as my spider control. Spiders are relatively slow to breed, but are relatively long-lived. And so it's kind of like if you pull them out of the environment, you know, once or twice a year go through, and as I said, get down in the basement and get in between the sill plates and all the little corners you can, I think it's as effective as anything else. Now, the activity increasing in the spring is as much related to temperature. It's just more to liking of spiders and insects to be active, and if it's too cold, everything is just in kind of a dormant state.
Okay, so there really, it sounds like there really isn't too much of a connection between the spiders in my house and the spiders on my house.
Would have to see who it is. There are some spiders that are traditionally more indoor spiders. There's some that are you would expect more likely to find outdoors. So, but there's enough indoor spiders. As I said, I don't know if I could go in a house and not find critters if I don't go looking around. And you know, the argument would be if it's the outdoor spiders, is there any way you can seal things up? Not, I mean, you're not going to do anything with siding, but, you know, you check around vent pipes and all those other things as being a potential access point into the house.
Could I tag on one more question about that?
Sure.
My basement is, it's one of those open walkways down to the basement. There's a little jig in a hall, and then you just walk down an open stairway. So in other words, I can't really close that off. But could I do a bug bomb down there and feel pretty confident that that would remain in the basement and not, excuse me, make its way up into through the jig and the stairway up into the rest of the house?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of bug bombs, and the reason for it is that they use very short-acting insecticides. They kill what's ever out in the open, but they don't penetrate anything. They don't have any residual. And so you give this false impression that you're killing everything in sight, and you're really not getting a whole lot of bang for the buck. There are some problems with them potentially being flammable in some circumstances. We've had explosions from them. And so in this case, I'm not sure that it's going to be worth using aside from the issue of your own exposure.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Phil Pelletieri will be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. We'll be back. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus, retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and comes by every couple months to talk with us. Question about an insect that's bothering you or you're just interested in? I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. We've been getting some great insect photos, and you can post your photo on our Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. And if you want to email us a question, go to talk@WPR.org. Brian in Independence up next. Brian, thanks for waiting.
Yes, hello. I have a question about an insect that I found a couple days ago on my bathroom wall. It kind of looked the size of a wood tick and the shape of a wood tick, and I thought that's what it was. I picked it off the wall and put it on a white piece of paper, and as I was kind of prodding it with the tweezers, I noticed on each side it had two long arms that resembled like blue crab claws. They were out from the body, quite long, and seemed to almost have like pincers on the end. Mm-hmm. I've never ever seen anything like that before.
Yeah, and it's a great description. It's a pseudoscorpion. Pseudoscorpions are a unique group of creatures. They are predators. They're harmless to people. You do find them at times indoors where they're feeding on ants and carpet beetles and other little things. But again, like so many of these things, there's not a whole lot to eat, so you never get overrun by them. And so it's kind of a unique creature, mostly a nighttime hunter, and they never get very big. So again, just a neat critter that you can kind of let go. And by nature, they seem to like to hide out in places that there's not a lot of activity. So it's back in closets and that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. That's maybe where it comes from. There's a dark closet, narrow linen closet next to the bathroom wall it was on.
Yeah, mm-hmm. could well be.
And would he have come, like, out of the attic?
Yeah, or walls. We used to have, you know, I used to see them in one of the homes that I own, like one or two a year. I mean, that was kind of common. And again, I think they were just out foraging for food. So I expect probably to see them more commonly at night. As I said, when things are kind of quiet, and then they go back into that kind of hiding places during the day.
Oh, okay. I've never in the woods. I've never seen anything, so I was really kind of perplexed about what it could be.
Yeah, and there are some species you can find in leaf litter if you really look carefully. But you know, they tend to play possum when things are disturbed and whatnot, so they're really kind of hard to pick up. But if you took a bunch of leaves and kind of sifted through them, that would be another place you might expect to find some.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you very much,
Don in Keewaskum. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Afternoon.
Afternoon, I guess it is, yeah.
A question about spiders being active outdoors in the winter. I was cross-country skiing up at Greenbush 3-4 weeks ago. Temperature is in the mid-20s, and I just crested a hill, and as I got to the top, I stopped and looked down, and between my skis was a spider just making his way across the trail, probably less than a dime in size, maybe brown. I was quite impressed. He wasn't even wearing mittens.
Yeah. I am too, because it's, you know, getting that temperatures. Now, you know, typically, and it's not just spiders, we have winter crane flies. I mean, there are more insects than you might think that come out in the winter. But, you know, it's this problem with being cold-blooded animals that to get their motors running enough, they have to get warmed up one way or another. So typically, they're quite dark-bodied. It's typically a sunny day, and we think sometimes they can find little niches where they can warm things up. And then, of course, once you start muscle movement, you do generate some heat. So, in other words, I would expect, you know, that's cold enough that I'm still a little surprised, but I would expect it might have been a little bit of a sunnier day or something else that there might have been some way that, again, it could find a little microenvironment to get things moving enough to be active and then go from there. But you'd think it's evolutionary-wise not a good decision because you take a wrong turn in some place that's cooler out of the sun, and all of a sudden things go south pretty quick if you're the spider. So
yeah.
All right, well, thank you for that information.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Bill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hey, good morning. Good afternoon. I was listening to your discussion about flies.
Yes?
Hello? Yep.
Oh,
we're still here.
We lost him. Oh, sorry. Sean, let's go to Sean then. We've got Sean with a question from West Dallas. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I've lived in Waukesha for about 20 years, and in August, about the second to third week in August, I've been fortunate enough to witness what I call a bug launch. There's thousands, tens of thousands of winged black ants. They're about maybe a half inch long. And if you look down in the grass, there's probably about six or seven of these little ants on each blade of grass. I got about a third of an acre. And in the late afternoon, they just take off, fly vertical.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a swarm.
It is a swarm.
What kind of, are you familiar with that?
Well, you know, it is, my first guess, it's another form of those field ants that we were talking about earlier in the show. It still could be cornfield ants, because both those species swarm in the late summer, in late afternoons. And, you know, the phenomena, as you describe, you know, you can be out there for a couple hours, there are just ants everywhere. I've even seen it where the birds, because there's all these flying ants, come in. And, you know, the strategy, we think, is that all the reproductives, the kings and queens, if you think of them that way, are leaving, trying to find mates from other nests, and so it makes sense they all come out at once. And the trigger is set usually late afternoon, sunny days, and the like, and it might go on for a week or so and then just shut off. If the weather changes, sometimes it will disappear for a couple days and then all of a sudden start again. But because of the timing of the year, I figure it's one of those two species. Carpenter ants, on the other hand, tend to swarm in May and June. So sometimes when we see these swarms, it indicates what potential species it would be.
And those aren't harmful to houses or anything?
No. Oh, no. Yeah, no, either of those ants are not ants that, you know, cause any destruction. And again, oftentimes people are not aware that there is a nest. You get this staging before they start flying, and that's what I think you're witnessing when you see these little clusters of ants on the ground, and they're all crawling around, and all of a sudden, as I said, you watch them and they'll set wing and get up in there. And it's the point that sometimes it literally looks like there's a haze or a smoke. There's so many ants flying at one time.
It's impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Sean.
Right. Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah, you bet. Jim in St. Croix Falls, hello to you.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you about a alternate way of getting rid of the paper wasps that I've tried, and it worked real well.
Okay.
It's a fake wasp nest. You can get them at garden centers. It's like a paper envelope that's in the shape of a wasp nest, and it has springs inside to spread it apart. And I was watching a female on my patio make her nest, and it was just fascinating. I watched her for about 3 or 4 weeks until it got kind of big, and it was sort of threatening. And then I hung one of those fake nests next to it, about 10 feet away, and next day they were all gone.
That's weird.
You know, I've read on some research, because some people will put these up before other nests show up, with a theory that the wasps feed the other nests and they know there's competition. Unfortunately, the research did not show a whole lot of relationships there. And I'm wondering, again, if something showed up and decided to eat the wasp that night, it was just kind of coincidental, because there's, you know, wasps, again, are so defensive. They put so much energy into doing the nest that it really, it's a life or death matter. They either, you know, will defend the nest, do whatever they do to stick around, but I can't see them picking up and leaving an old nest behind.
Because then they'd have to start all over again.
They start from all over, and that is supposed to be stressful. So as I said, it's an interesting observation. It's worth trying again to see if this the same thing. But my first inclination is to wonder if something showed up and munched on them. You know, whether we get raccoons. Well, now, typically when that happens, though, you see the nest has been torn apart. You know, so that doesn't seem to be fitting what you experienced. But
no, the nest was intact, and it was in a place that would be real hard to get to. It's on the soffit.
Very interesting.
It was really fun watching her build the nest and make it larger and then get help from the babies. It was really neat.
Yeah. And we have two groups of paper wasps. We have the ones that make, you know, various sized nests that are enclosed, so you cannot see the comb inside, and that includes the yellow jackets and the bald-faced hornet and the like. And then we have the Polistes wasps, where they make a paper nest, but if you look from underneath, you can see all the little cells.
Oh.
Now, typically, the Polistes like to get in overhangs and the like, so they're often up above you. And relatively speaking, they're much smaller. You know, maybe the size of a softball would be a good-sized Polistes nest, whereas if you talk about like a bald-faced hornet, I mean, they're the size of two basketballs in some cases. So, as I said, we do have groups of different paper wasps that are here, but they all kind of work the same. They're all predators on insects and the like, as far as normally feeding their young, and they have a queen, and they have prey, that kind
sure.
of thing. So,
there we go. Thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate the call. And Alan in McHenry, Illinois, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks, Larry. I was just going to say thanks for the great show and the great guest, but also I had a question on identifying an insect. It's very, very small. It's kind of like a very lazy crescent shape. Like its nose points up and its tail points up. It's a very light fluorescent yellow, and it kind of tail goes to a pointy orange color, and its legs are translucent. Like a clear whitish color.
And where do you see these things?
I found this one in Palatine, Illinois. And it was outside. It was in the summer when I found them. I found like one or two. I've done internet searches and field guides. I've looked through, and I can't find it anywhere.
Okay. Did it look like these things that were sticking up could be more like filaments? Where I'm going is that, you know, there are some things like woolly aphids and whatnot that make secretions. And so, you know, you get these very interesting projections and the like. Some of them, in fact, don't even look like insects. It look like little pieces of flying cotton candy or something. And, you know, I'm going that way, that it's something that's camouflaging itself. There's also some especially larvae of some of the beetles that do some funny things to you know, they put debris on their backs and whatnot to look something different. And I'm wondering if that's why you're having trouble, is that, you know, so many of the pictures are what the critter looks like rather than the way they camouflage themselves. Did you get a picture at all?
I do have a picture of it.
Okay.
Where do you want me to send it to?
Probably the best that you can send to PJ at the Insect Lab.
UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Actually, if you've got it, you can post it up on our Facebook page right now if you want.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd love to see the picture, because then maybe I can get, you know, sometimes we all describe things differently. And as I said, I'm kind of fishing here a little bit from your description, but if I see a picture, I think I can give you an idea pretty quick.
So just go to the Larry Mueller show.
Okay, it wasn't those fuzzy things. I know what you're talking about. It's really, it's got like a little fluff ball on it, and it kind of floats around. It kind of carries it.
Mm-hmm. Send it as quick as you can. We'll tell you, we got about 10 minutes left or 8 minutes left, so send it as quick as you can, and we'll get it up there, Alan, and we'll see what we can come up with. And thanks. Thanks a lot. I'm interested to look for, see what
The other thing, I'm thinking maybe it's a tussock moth, the more I think of it, but I said we'll see what we get.
Jerry in Green Bay. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have found a few stink bugs in my home just over the last couple of days, and I had a new mattress and bedding set delivered to my home. And we kept the big pieces of plastic that they were wrapped in just to recycle them to use them for when we paint and things like that. And they did stay in my living room overnight, and then the next morning, you know, I took those big pieces of plastic out into the garage. So since then, I found a couple stink bugs. Do I need to be concerned that the stink bugs can bore into and be inside the mattress or box spring set?
No, not at all.
I figured that, but I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, no, they like to crawl into protected places like underneath shingles and that kind of stuff just to spend the winter, and then when they warm up they leave, so they're really not capable of burrowing per se into things. They said they just kind of squeeze a bit, and there's nothing that would interest them in a mattress other than, again, if you had a bunch of mattresses in a garage, because there's places between one mattress and the next. I can see that'd be a nice place to spend the winter, nice and insulated and the like, but there's no worries.
Okay, so I figured they probably were just inside the protective plastic of the set.
Yeah, and you kind of, it wouldn't be surprising in a warehouse, because doors are opening and whatnot, that critters, just kind of accumulate in something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Pete in Stone Lake, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yeah, I got some old pine lumber out in the garage, and it's got old tunnels burrowed right through the wood. This all happened, you know, about 10 years ago, but I was wondering what caused that. What kind of a bug or something caused that?
Sure. It's quite common if lumber is cut, trees are cut, and the wood is not kiln dried, that you can get insect activity for 2 and even 3 years afterwards. But the story is the insects were in the wood when it was cut. And many of those insects can leave some pretty big holes and trails and the like. But as the wood is drying, it is no longer suitable, so they can't breed in it anymore. And so, as I said, it's kind of a one shot and you're done. And we get this quite commonly in furniture, that was not kiln-dried lumber, and people use, you know, small logs and stuff to have kind of a rustic bed, and all of a sudden the sawdust gets coming out, and you get an insect that's 2 inches long and big and scary looking, and instead they're usually beetles for the most part, although there's a couple other critters that can do it. The other side of it is when wood is left outside for a period of time, there is much smaller insects in the powder post beetle group that can attack it. They leave very tiny holes, about the size of a BB or the like. They leave a very fine powder that's almost like talcum powder. They are capable, and they don't get in the green high-moisture lumber. They get in the more seasoned wood, although pine is less susceptible to... The true powder post beetles are more of an issue on oaks and hickories and some of the larger vessel woods. So as I said, whether you had longhorn wood borers, metallic wood borers, which are both beetles, there's something called a horntail, which is a type of very primitive wasp-like creature. It can't sting. Those all would be found in pine logs in lumber, and I bet you that's the critters that were there.
Yeah, could you name them right again, please?
So longhorn wood borer?
Yeah.
Okay, that's one group. Metallic wood borer, those are really shiny, look like pieces of metal.
Yeah.
And horntails, look up horntails. Those are the wasp-like creature that get into wood.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Dwayne in Weston, hello, thank you for calling.
Great show. Say, has your guest ever heard of, two things? One is, like if we're up north fishing, there'll be a column of, I think they're male mosquitoes above your boat, and you look up and it looks like it never ends. And if you move, they'll follow your boat across the lake. Mm-hmm. They never bite you. They're bigger than a female mosquito. And secondly, last year in my yard, I noticed a lot of like June bug shells in the lawn. Does that mean I'm going to have that, you know, anything about the summer bugs like that? Does that mean that gets in your lawn and,
there is a relationship with June beetles that the years that you have heavy numbers, it's the year after that has grub problems.
Grub catch.
Right. It doesn't guarantee it. But that's the pattern, is you see it the year after, you potentially, you can get a pretty good idea this spring, I think, is that if you can just pull back a little bit of sod and see if there's any grubs there and what the numbers, you know.
Sure.
One per square foot, no big deal. 20 per square foot, that's not good.
What do you put on that, you know, or just any?
Right. So now, what you witnessed is another type of mating swarm. It's probably a column of my first guess is lake flies, which are related to mosquitoes, but they're a non-biting form.
Not the mayfly.
Right. And so what you get, and again, I've seen pictures, they almost look like little tornadoes. The columns are so big and so dense. And these things are visual in a sense that they use kind of markers for making the swarms. You know, some people say, you know, you're out walking and you go by this trash can, and every afternoon there's a little cloud of insects above it. And again, for whatever reason, they're marking off of that. And I think the same thing, they're marking off your boat. And when the boat moves, the column goes. And, you know, what's supposed to be happening is the females will come into that mating swarm, pick a mate, and then go off. But typically, again, there are clouds more often. And the species I'm familiar with of males, and you know, it's kind of a singles bar.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Heather in Madison emailed to say she has a beehive in one of her flower pots. She wants her pot back and is wondering if she can move the bees without killing them.
Now, the only bee that overwinters as a colony are honeybees. And, you know, my guess, it was honeybees, to be honest. On a warm day, you'd see the bees coming and going. So most likely whoever else was in there are from these groups that die off in the fall. And then in the spring, the new queens start things in other places. So, yeah, I would think there isn't any problem dealing with it.
And Catherine on Facebook wondering what kind of a bug is leaving very itchy bites on elastic areas of her clothing. They last for days, the bites do, and she gets them after weeding in the flower bed.
That is very suggestive of chiggers.
Yeah,
because
sure is.
Chiggers are little mites, and by nature they're parasites of insects. But chiggers, if you're in an area, the frustrating thing about chiggers is that by the time you start to have the irritation, they're already gone. So all these remedies that you got to put nail polish on them to kill them, well, they're gone anyway. But they burrow in. They often will be in places where clothing is constrictive. And so that's why it's often the belt line and the sock line and the like. And they can become incredibly itchy, very weepy, last for a number of days. It's not a good experience. And so I think if you know there's an area that you've run into this on a regular basis, if you go in there weeding, you're going to have to be careful because it's likely an environment you might expect to pick them up again. A quick remedy is when you're done weeding is go in, take a quick shower, and do a good job of toweling off. What you're doing is brushing those little critters off before they get a chance. In other areas where they're very problematic, some of the tick sprays and repellents will work. They even used to use sulfur dust around socks and other things. But as I said, I think some of the commercial sprays now are probably more effective and put them around your sock line and other places so you basically prevent them from getting to you.
And we've got a video from Leslie who wonders what this spider is.
I can't see the spider well enough to be sure, but the way it's working, I wonder if it's one of the funnel web spiders, because they will construct this little sheltered tube that they live in, and then the webbing comes out, and then when things get caught, they come jumping out on it. So as I said, that's my first inclination. I just can't. The unfortunate thing to really identify a spider, I got to see its eyes and see how big they are and the shape they are and all that other stuff. But just the way it's behaving, it's kind of a classic funnel web or weaver spider, and they're really quite common in the state.
We didn't get that insect up yet, but Phil, check our Facebook page this afternoon and maybe you can identify that insect for that previous call.
Definitely, definitely.
Always a pleasure, Phil. Thanks for joining us. Phil Pelletieri, a Distinguished Faculty Associate in the UW-Madison Department of Entomology. He'll be back in a couple months, and we'll do this all over again. And he'll go back to our Facebook page, see if he can find out what that insect is that we were talking about earlier. Tomorrow, Mary Mellum is back to give us some last-minute tax tips. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.